hundreds of thousands hold their breath on Merseyside. It's Xabi Alonso for 3-3, it's saved! And Alonso follows it in! It's wonderful! It's marvellous! It's 3-3 in the European Cup final!
And this is the Red Agenda on The Athletic. Welcome along to another podcast. I'm Steve Hothersall. Thank you for your company, as always, James Pearce and Simon Hughes. Will join me to talk through some of the big issues of the moment. Should have been the weekend, of course, where the city was alight with celebrations. Celebrations of Liverpool lifting the Premier League trophy. Not to be. Very silent down on the Dock Road and, of course, all other areas of the city. Brilliant piece on The Athletic written by Simon about that. So we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the anniversary of the Barcelona game, one of the sort of collective moments for the football club. And a little bit later on in the podcast, I'll play you the piece that I've done with Dominic Matteo, who's faced the biggest fight of his life in the past 6 months. He's given us an exclusive interview on battling back from a rare brain tumour. It's a remarkable story, and Dominic, a fantastic servant to the football club, and thankfully, hopefully, there's positive signs ahead for him. Right, let's catch up with our guys. Welcome along, Simon. Everything okay?
Brilliant, Steve. Thanks, yeah.
Yeah, you must be tired after your long walk from Melwood to Anfield. We'll catch up on that in a moment. James, you all right?
Very good, thanks, Steve. Yeah, yourself?
Yeah, sympathy for Simon that he's actually had to put in some hard graft this week.
No, just long overdue that he put a proper shift in.
So James does.
I've become the Athletic's rambling correspondent in more ways than one.
I've noticed this. James does half marathons. You're into rambling. It was quite nice anyway. This should have been the weekend where the city was painted red, and actually the face of the city was publicised across the world, but it's eerily silent. It should have been Liverpool against Chelsea and Jordan Henderson lifting a trophy for us all to celebrate. So in advance of that, you thought you'd make the walk from Melwood to Anfield to gauge what, Simon?
Well, at the start of the season, one of my editors, David Jordan, I'm sure you won't mind me name checking him, suggested that I walked from Jürgen Klopp's house in Formby to Anfield, which was, I think it was a 14-mile walk in total. It was actually the first sort of match report that went up, match report-related piece anyway, that went up on The Athletic when the website launched in August. And much to the amusement of a lot of colleagues who seemed to revel in seeing me sweat it out over the course of a day and arriving at Anfield and all sorts of bother. You know, I quite enjoyed doing the piece in the end. I did enjoy the walk, and it's made me discover something that I didn't know that I liked. But obviously last week we were talking through ideas, and David just suggested that it'd be good to sort of recreate a bit of that, obviously while practicing social distancing and just sort of try and gauge how the city feels, really, a city in lockdown, which is meant to be celebrating. I think it's well known that Liverpool is a party city, really, and particularly when Liverpool Football Club does well on the pitch, you know, that the fans know how to celebrate, and that was reflected last summer when Liverpool won the Champions League. And you know, it's a bit difficult to write about it at the moment because, you know, if you try and reflect any level of sadness or frustration, it can come across quite selfish, I suppose, given that you know there are bigger issues at play. But you know, as you walk around, you just can't help but feel and think about what it would be like if Liverpool were to win the league and what the celebrations would be like. And it was eerily silent across the city, really. I mean, I know a few people have been pointing towards pictures from parks and this, that and the other about too much crowding going on. But if you spend any time on the ground floor and watch people, you realise that people's behaviour has actually adjusted, and people in the main are sort of observing the things that the government is saying at the moment. But yeah, I spoke to quite a few people on the route and just tried to reflect the feeling and level of emotion that's floating about at the moment.
I think the piece reflected not just people's need, but the city's need for that moment. That moment that the city had been waiting for, perhaps in 2005, James, when all of a sudden it was a new dawn, a new birth. We had it a little bit last year, of course, with the Champions League win. But the need for a championship win is something entirely different, and one that we've been waiting for so long. So when that moment passes without any notification of it, any ability to celebrate it, it becomes particularly poignant.
Yeah, and I think that came across in Simon's piece that he wrote, because you know everyone knows just how important football is to the people of this city, and there's the usual caveats. Of course, there's more important things in the world, and that's been rammed home to everyone in the last couple of months. But yeah, it still doesn't take away from the fact that the weekend just gone would have been absolutely momentous. It would have been the scenes after Madrid probably times two in terms of the emotion and the intensity and the feeling around the place and just the just how many people we would have seen out on the streets of Liverpool and it is it's the absolute opposite of that, isn't it? With some people when the sun comes out, some of the parks. I've been pretty busy in the last week or so, but in general, when you go around the city, it is eerily quiet. And what should have been, the one of the biggest parties this city had ever seen, it was the absolute opposite. And I think that's it. Then there is a definite sadness attached to that. And I don't think as Simon said, you say that and you almost get accused of for God's sake, there's more important things, but of course there are. But there is a lot of sadness attached to the fact that having waited 30 years and then we've seen, an absolutely extraordinary Liverpool team rewrite the record books over the last 8-9 months, to have been, so close to getting the job done, to be deprived of that iconic moment is incredibly sad.
You met all sorts of different people on your route, Simon, many demonstrating the need for the city to experience this. I think there was one shopkeeper who said to you, it would remind the country that we're not going to go away. So it's a very Liverpool statement.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the thing with Liverpool, is that you can't really separate either of its football clubs from and their stories from the city itself. And I think the point that I was sort of trying to get across is that, that this virus hits Liverpool, hits everywhere, of course, but Liverpool as a city is sort of, although the city centre's rediscovered itself economically over the last sort of 15 to 20 years, around the sort of fringe areas and stretch beyond the city centre. And you see that there's still a massive struggle that is happening, which sort of stems, back decades, really. You could go back to the 1970s, 80s, and why there's a lot of areas that still feel underdeveloped. And a few people have said to me, well, there's lots of places which feel the same way. But I do think that in Liverpool, people are more willing to talk about it in a more sort of open way, really. And just because there's an area that's struggling, it doesn't mean that you sort of ignore it just because the city centre's doing well for itself, which it has been for a long time. And there's no doubt, that Liverpool as a city is going to get hit hard by coronavirus because, of the city's economy now, which by and large has become a tourist destination. So that's another concern, which I never really got into the piece, is that, if over the next few months people aren't going to be able to travel to England, where does that leave Liverpool again? And I met a lot of people, on the route, sort of, again, kept my distance from them, sort of shouting across the road, having conversations like that. It was a bit strange. And it's quite clear, the people in Liverpool, there's a perception, I think, that this desire to get the Premier League started again is solely for the benefit of Liverpool, which, if you actually speak to people in Liverpool, people are quite sort of philosophical about it all and sort of accept that there's bigger things at play here and that it might not be able to start very soon. I might not even be able to start again, despite, the desire and the wish for the team to get across the line in the title. I mean, there was one guy who lives probably about 10 houses up from Anfield, who'd just recovered from coronavirus and was describing in detail to a friend who was just riding past on a bike just how painful, you know, it is and how dangerous it is. And, you know, he seems like he's in a state of shock. A lady just down the road who's actually three houses up from the centenary stand, and she was self-isolating and you know, big Liverpool fan, but was, again, quite philosophical about, you know, the way forward and what may or may not happen. And I think it just reminded me that, you know, there's a life that exists beyond the beyond social media in many ways. A lot of people who might not use that platform sort of are actually a bit more reasonable about the way things are. And don't get me wrong, they're all desperate to see Liverpool win the title, but I think that this idea that it's just, you know, Liverpool people aren't thinking about sort of the bigger picture, I just think it's just not true. It became very clear to me on that walk. And it's a very weird experience, because particularly on a match day, Anfield is transformed at the best of times. You know, it's become an area which has arguably suffered over a long period of time because of the presence of football and Liverpool not being able to move grounds. And that's led to like sort of a stagnation in the city, in the area's development. But it was really noticeable the other day. There was just very few people knocking about and people just hanging around on the doorsteps, having a chat, you know, over walls and stuff like that. It wasn't particularly lively. So yeah, wasn't the most uplifting walk of my life, I've got to be honest. But there was, you know, at least the sun was shining, I suppose.
You picked a good day for it. I mean, football, James, serves this incredible purpose in people's lives, to not have that moment in the way it should be done. In other words, the trophy lift and that moment of realisation and celebration, but to not have it with the friends, the family, and fellow supporters takes away an awful lot, doesn't it? I mean, personally, how are you digesting that? Because I've thought about it a few times. You know, if, for example, the trophy was to be presented in an empty stadium to Jordan Henderson, how would he look? How would his teammates react to it?
Yeah, and I mean, I just think it would be very, very surreal, wouldn't it, to see that moment that, you know, speaking personally, I was 12 years old when Liverpool last won the title. And you know, in 89-90, at the time, it didn't even seem to be that big a deal, because having grown up in an era when it was, you know, it was almost like usual service resumed, Liverpool lifting that trophy. It is, you know, to think that at the moment, that is the absolute best case scenario, that what, back end of June, early July, Jordan Henderson will be lifting that trophy in a neutral venue is the most likely outcome. Especially, I think, you're right in terms of, you know, it's so integral to so many people in this city, what it means, and especially all the heartache and all the near misses and the false dawns that you know, fans have lived through, to be that close to that moment. And then to be denied it, you know. I think, you know, I spoke to quite a lot of people this weekend who, you know, I think it was a time of almost, you know, taking stock and thinking, you know, God, do you know what, you know, how good would this weekend have been if things had panned out differently? I think the only thing I can, you know, you're trying to grasp onto positives, and the one thing I do think is that, you know, regardless of how things pan out with this season, you know, the reality is some of the gloss has been taken off it because of the circumstances, and I just think that gives this group of players and the management and the coaches a huge amount of hunger to go and defend that title and be able to savor the moments they're not going to be able to have this time around with that, you know, that special atmosphere inside Anfield, with that parade around the city. So, you know, maybe that will give Liverpool an extra edge next season that maybe might not have been there if they'd been able to savour, you know, every single drop of the emotion and the achievement that they looked like they were going to be able to savour a couple of months back.
Yeah, I was going to lead on to that. I mean, this sense that if you can't have it done perfectly this season, does the importance of next season ramp up a notch or two? Is the desire, the relevance of the season greater than ever, Simon?
I mean, it depends when next season is, I suppose, doesn't it? I mean, if I was a player now, I'd be pretty concerned about, like, sort of, you know, sort of the momentum of the team. You know, it was Liverpool, it's fair to say, they'd obviously dropped a few points and sort of got knocked out of a few of the cups just before it ended. But I just think that with the Liverpool team being the sort of the age it is, it's sort of, I think the average age is sort of a peak age at the moment. And I do wonder whether the players sort of wonder whether there's a potential that some of the best years might be taken away from them, which is, you know, a genuine concern. I mean, again, it might sound selfish if a player came out and said that, but that's the reality, isn't it, that they're facing at the moment. Yeah, I mean, I think that Jurgen Klopp, being the sort of manager in the way he is, he tries to turn everything into a positive, doesn't he? And, you know, from a Liverpool point of view, if they were to able to go and sort of start the next season again anytime this year, you know, you'd imagine he'd find a way to get the players really, really motivated if they aren't already. I mean, I'd imagine that they would be, because, you know, he sort of, that's why he signs these players, that they're motivated by the right things. And, you know, Jordan Henderson lifting a Premier League title in St. George's Park, it's not going to be the same as lifting the trophy as he did in Madrid, with the level of emotion that was involved. Because again, you know, would a footballer feel sort of the, you know, showing excitement and joy at winning first Premier League trophy in 30 years when there's obviously still suffering going on around the country? It might not strike the right note. So it would be weird, but I do think that knowing Liverpool and the sort of the staff that they've got behind Klopp and the players that are there, they'd be absolutely desperate to sort of try and go and win things again, you know, in circumstances where people feel good about everything again. So who knows? I just think it's quite a long, feels like a long way away at the moment, that, doesn't it? You know, there's obviously conversations going about when football this season will restart, but I've said before, I just think, you know, until, you know, people saying that it should just go to next season, but how can you think like that when you don't even know when next season will begin? It's that'll be the next stage of the debate, I guess.
It's hard to conjure. One of those images you do get when you think of the moment when a team wins and collectively comes together, particularly is the closeness. So whether it's in the game you referred to, James, back 30 years ago, you know, the image of Rushy in that team lineup, they're all collectively together, Steve McMahon and what have you. If you see the Champions League win last year, they're all very much all over each other. Jurgen Klopp's all for togetherness, isn't he? But you'll never see that image of this group of players almost all over each other, around each other, celebrating as one.
No, and you're right, and that, you know, especially when that has been so absolutely key to what Klopp has created at Liverpool, you know, that unity, that spirit that we've seen come to the fore when Liverpool's backs have been against the wall in various scenarios in the last 18 months especially. So yeah, it is going to be very, very strange when football comes back. I think even as Simon said, you know, if you know, say middle of June, which seems to be the best case scenario at the moment, you know there's talk about, you know, you can't really even have, you know, goals being celebrated in terms of teammates jumping on each other and trying to, you know, even what was their talk last week of how they're going to try and police kind of players spitting on the, you know, on the grass. And it's just going to be a very bizarre scenario, isn't it, when if football does return as expected, in terms of it is going to be a very different spectacle. And as Simon said, you know, it's even that emotion and the joy, you know, I think it will be severely tempered by the circumstances around completing the season, because, you know, the reality is that the reason why the Premier League is going to be is much more likely to be finished than certainly, you know, as we're expecting this week, you know, Leagues 1 and 2 to be confirmed that they won't be completed is because of the economic consequences, and, you know, there being so much money at stake, you know, not only in terms of fulfilling these fixtures, but in terms of satisfying the requirements for who plays in what division and who competes in which European competition next season. So, you know, I suppose there was, you know, one little chink of positivity last week was Melwood partially reopening, I think in the middle of last week, and But you know, even that, you know, it's, you know, the players have been told that you know, they're not allowed to use any of the interior buildings, that they're just doing fitness work on the on the outside pitches at Melwood. But you know, it's, I think it's three players at a time. You know, almost they essentially have a pitch each. So there's, you know, that kind of camaraderie and spirit you refer to. It's, you know, it's a world away, isn't it, from three players being able to turn up at Melwood at the same time and each having their own pitch, and then getting in their cars after they've done their fitness work and going home. It's just all a very surreal setup at the moment,
isn't it? Just and by the way, if you've not managed to catch James's picture that he posted on his social media from 1990, it's well worth a look at a young Pierce, isn't it, Simon? He
oh, very much so. Yeah,
he displays all the qualities of a young
somebody
red.
Called me a young Peter Beardsley. Is that true, James?
I think that was you.
Oh, of course.
Fab though. At a time when I don't think people took cameras to grounds. Well, not least unless you were with James Pierce. So he's got a lovely memento there. Of his time at that Coventry game.
Shevchenko scored the winner 2 years ago. He's up against Dudek. Will he hand Liverpool the European Cup?
Yes!
European champions! Jerzy Dudek with a penalty save!
This is the Red Agenda on The Athletic. And thanks to our good pals at beer52.com, you have the opportunity to sip eight delicious, painstakingly sourced craft beers from around the world. All you need to do is go to beer52.com/agenda and pay the postage, £4.95. So if that wasn't enough, as a listener of the show, you get two extra free beers. That's 10 free beers. And Beer 52, very much the beer pioneers. Travel the globe, find the best and most interesting beer from the very best craft breweries. They're now the world's most popular craft beer discovery club. And the beauty of Beer 52... as you can leave at any time. The power's in your hands and they deliver your beer straight to your front door. You don't even need to leave the house. Included is the award-winning craft beer magazine Ferment and a beery snack. That's thrown in as well. Go to beer52.com/agenda to get your free case. And don't forget, right now, listeners get two extra free beers. This is the Red Agenda on The Athletic. James Pearce, Simon Hughes and myself, Steve Hothersall, every week talking through the big issues at Liverpool Football Club. And of course, we've just gone past the anniversary of one of the club's greatest moments. So the one-year anniversary of Liverpool versus Barcelona, a night when legend was made and individuals certainly created memories that we'll never, ever forget. It's hard to think that was 1 year ago. So Simon, just give us your recollections of that night at Anfield. Your hope, your expectation heading into a game 3-0 down against Messi and Suarez and co.
Well, you know, I remember, obviously, I covered the game at the new camp as well the week before. It was an incredible week. I mean, I was saying to James last week, you know, I do think that sort of May, June, and I suppose April as well is probably the best 3 months of my work and life. And I've got Liverpool to thank for that, really, you know, going to such amazing places. But after that Barcelona game at the Nou Camp, you know, it was very flat coming home. I mean, it felt like the season was over because it was pretty certain that the City would go and beat Brighton the following 2 weekends later. You know, Liverpool had still quite a lot of work to do to try and catch City in the league. You know, haven't gone through that season where they played so well, you know, relentless to end up potentially empty-handed when it comes to trophies was very deflating. But, you know, that's the context for the game, really. So you're obviously going into that game just thinking, I mean, part of me did think if they get the first goal, you know, Liverpool are going to have a great chance because, you know, you just know that when there's a glimmer of hope and Anfield can smell blood, you know, they're going to make it very difficult for the opposition. But it was the level of performance of Messi that the week before that just made you think it's going to be very hard to do that, because I've got to be honest, it was one of the greatest individual performances I've ever seen of any player against Liverpool, probably the very best. But he was obviously very quiet on the night at Anfield, and Liverpool did a great job of roughing him up, which I absolutely love that element of Liverpool performance. They got really nasty on the night.
Particularly Andy Robertson.
particularly Andy Robertson. I mean, yeah, I mean, people forget he got in, he went off the pitch at half time as well, you know, and James Milner had to go to left back. Everything was against Liverpool. And just to round off the story, I mean, I put this up on Twitter the other day, and it just, this sort of, for me, so really rounded off the night, because it got in late, you know, early hours of the morning. My wife, who's she's from a family of Evertonians, and she sort of, I've got to be honest, has probably come more towards the Liverpool side of things over the last 15 years since meeting me. But she really doesn't care that much for football, though. She tolerates it because of obviously my interest in it, and I guess, you know, suppose it pays for part of the mortgage as well. So she came through the door, and she was like, oh, whispered, you know, what was the score? And I said, oh, 4-0. And she was like, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that sort of thing. And I was like, no, that they won 4-0. And she leapt from the bed, couldn't believe it, you know, spent the next hour or two watching all the goals on, you know, on a phone, and talking to me about how this had happened, this miraculous event. And, you know, I didn't get to sleep, I think, till the very early hours that morning, because I was up writing my match report for the night overnight. And it was just an incredible, incredible event. I've got to be honest, I for me, James might disagree, I don't know, but I thought it was better than Chelsea in 05 for a lot of different reasons. For me, it was just the most incredible turnaround I've certainly ever seen, even certainly on a par with Istanbul in terms of turning a result around when you just least expect it, mainly because Liverpool were so under strength on the night.
Yes, you wouldn't say the Chelsea game was a miracle, would you? But this appears to sort of equate alongside, James, the miracle of Istanbul.
Oh, 100%, yeah. I think it is all the circumstances around it, isn't it? I think, I usually class myself as quite an optimistic person, but I must... when I parked up on Stanley Park that night, to me, it just didn't feel like a Champions League semi-final second leg, for the simple reason that I just had that, you know, that feeling in the pit of your stomach that was like, you know, how did Liverpool possibly get themselves out of this hole that they've dug for themselves from the previous week in the Nou Camp. And I must admit, like, initially walking up to the ground that night, I remember thinking, I wonder if the atmosphere might not be, you know, the one of those like absolutely iconic Anfield nights, for the simple reason that, you know, there was such a mountain to climb. And then I saw the red puffs of smoke from Anfield Road, and then the absolute din from outside the Arcles, and then suddenly it was, you know, 10, 15, 20 deep all the way along, and it was absolute pandemonium. And you thought, oh, well, you know, there's certainly many people here who do believe it's possible. And then, yeah, I think, you know, the early goal just gave everyone, didn't it, that glimmer of hope that was required. And then, do you know what, just everything about that night was just absolutely sensational. You know, when you think, you know, no Salah, no Firmino, you know, Robertson going off injured, Henderson barely walk at half time and having to have pain-killing injections to get himself back out there. You know, Firmino getting the early yellow, and then he was, you know, probably his best game in a Liverpool shirt after that. And I think Simon's right. I've never experienced an Anfield night quite like that, in terms of noise and just in terms of the scale of the achievement on the field. Because, you know, to me, Messi is the greatest player I've ever seen in the flesh play the game. And for him to be humbled in that kind of manner, and, you know, just even the other things, like, you know, I remember being at the press conference the night before the game, when, you know, Luis Suarez was talking about how great it was to be back, and how he was convinced he was going to get a great reception because the Liverpool fans have so much respect for him, and everyone will remember what Anglo-Saxon phrase was echoing around Anfield after, you know, it was, you know, Anfield was at its absolute spiky, intimidating best, and also, you know, inspirational in terms of what it did for Klopp's players.
Can I just say about Suarez there? I mean, that's one of the sort of the sort of underrated narratives through the night, I think, that what happened to him. Because, you know, I think it just shows that you know, he thought that he was going to get a good reception, but he behaved in the way he behaved quite a lot of times when he was in a Liverpool shirt, and set the rules of engagement. And I think it sums up the way Liverpool people think. They thought, well, you know, if you're going to make it difficult for us, we're going to make it doubly difficult for you. And he collapsed as a man that night. I mean, the first half, he was all over the place trying to run amok. When he realised that nobody was going to actually sing his name and he was actually going to get the opposite of that, he just sort of faded into the background. I thought it was an incredible sort of reflection of just how powerful a crowd can be. I mean, Luis Suarez in a Liverpool shirt felt indestructible at times, you know, just didn't seem to care about anything. And the way the crowd turned on him, I just thought it was a great reflection of the way it should be in sport in many ways. It's like, okay, like, respect him as a player, and I'm sure if he came back again to play for another team, he probably would get a good reception. But on that night, because of the way he acted, people reacted in turn and actually showed him what's what. And he looked crestfallen at the end of that night, absolutely devastated. I remember him walking through the mix zone, having lost, having been humiliated by a crowd used to sing his name. I don't think he expected that at all. And That really set the tone for the night. I think he made a massive mistake by trying to wind up the crowd, because they turned on him straight away and it created this absolute cauldron of an atmosphere. It really backfired, I thought.
Yeah, from the level of adoration that Luis Suarez had at Liverpool Football Club to that night, and perhaps the damage he did he permanently sever, do you think, James, the relationship between himself and the Liverpool fans that night?
No, do you know what? I wouldn't say permanently sever, just because I just think it was one of them ones where it was like, do you know what? What goes around comes around. And that, you know, it was...
There was a lot of hostility towards him, wasn't there?
Yeah. And do you know what? Because it was a means to an end that night, I don't think... Say if Luis Suarez came back in, I don't know, 2 years' time and played in a Legends game at Anfield, I actually think he'd get a decent reception, because I don't... It was, you know, it was almost like that was just the terms of engagement, yeah, on the night. It was, you know, and I think the same with Suarez. You know, he was a disgrace in the first leg in the Nou Camp, you know, brandishing the imaginary cards and doing everything he possibly could to get under the Liverpool player's skin. But that's the reality. And I never really understood really why. And, you know, and I saw a lot of the reaction on social media after the first leg about what a disgrace he was. And it was like, But that's Luis Suarez. He was exactly the same when he played for Liverpool. The difference is that when he's wearing your shirt, you love him for it, and when he's doing it against you, you hate him, and that's the reality of it. And I just thought he was definitely stunned by the reaction that he got. But I wouldn't say it permanently severed anything. I think the other kind of subplot we haven't mentioned so far to that was obviously the Coutinho factor as well. The fact that, you know, Coutinho. He'd made such a big thing in terms of fighting to get away from Liverpool because he wanted to win the biggest prizes. And, you know, that was such a sweet subplot for me as well. The fact that, you know, I remember, I think it was Fabinho dumping him on his backside early on and just the noise around Anfield. And Coutinho was like a little boy playing in a man's game that night, and, you know, gets substituted, I think, after about an hour and, you know, jeered off. And it was, and you know, like, Even in terms of believing that night, I'd say it was only when the third goal went in that I went from thinking this won't happen to this 100% will happen. And more than anything, it was the body language of the Barcelona players. I think once Ronaldo made it 3-0, you could just see that to a man they looked absolutely lost. It took a bit of genius from Trent Alexander-Arnold and a cute finish from Origi to kill them off. But that was the moment for me when I thought this is 100% on.
It was very much a collective effort from the Liverpool team. But actually, obviously, a few heroes emerge from it. Gini Wijnaldum and his header. It does almost look a little bit like Steven Gerrard's header in Istanbul. But Divock Origi and the goal at the end. So Trent to Divock and, you know, corner taken quickly. Goal scored. But Divock Origi, the man for the big moment. We talk about David Fairclough as the super sub. Look what he's got under his belt now, Simon.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's had an incredible story. I mean, I think I said a few... episodes ago on this podcast that, you know, no matter, he can do anything he wants now. His name forever will be associated with what happened last season, you know, scoring the goals against Everton, or the goal against Everton, and then various other points towards the end of the season, scoring in a Champions League final, and can do whatever he wants now. It doesn't matter. I mean, you mentioned Wijnaldum there. Another little thing that you forget, he played up front in the new camp. He played as Liverpool's yeah. number nine at the new camp. And actually, I thought he did a pretty decent job. Liverpool were just wasteful in front of goal that night. You know, Salah hitting the post, various other chances which he backed them to score. Liverpool played brilliantly at the new camp. That was what was so demoralising. It just felt like that, you know, as well as Liverpool could play, Messi with one swipe of the boot can absolutely kill you. And that's what made the following week so much better. I mean, Wijnaldum came on having done Klopp a massive favour the week before, let's face it, I think, and to get dropped really in the critical game of the season must have hurt him a lot. And he came on like a man possessed. I mean, I sort of felt a bit differently to James, because at half time, I remember having a few conversations with people in the press room, and they said that everybody seemed a little bit, oh, they started the first half really well, faded a little bit towards the end of the second half, but the crowd was still, you know, really at it. And I just thought, if they get the second goal here, there's no way that they're not going to win this game. As soon as you score after half time, even if it's in the 70th, 80th, even 85th minute, there's every chance that you're going to get a third. It's just, that's the way Anfield is. And I know, like, I understand why, you know, other fans say it's a bit of a myth, and when clubs, you know, like, you know, from other parts of the country, which don't mean, when the games don't mean as much, it can be a bit flat Anfield. But on that night, it was absolutely at its best, you know, at its belligerent best, which... And I go back to the Suarez thing for me. That summed the whole thing up. That, you know, okay, we respect you as a player, but, you know, if you're going to try and do bad by us, we will turn on you and give you hell. And that's what he got. And he looked like a broken man at the end of it. And as I said, I think if Barcelona had somehow won that game, I suspect maybe his relationship with Liverpool fans may have been, I don't want to say ruined, but like I think people would look on him differently historically. But I think because Liverpool won, you know, they can accept it a bit more what he did on that night, because he obviously failed. In fact, I would say more than anybody, he was the cause for a lot of what Barcelona were trying backfiring, really, because it just fired up the crowd, totally miscalculated the mood.
I mean, how many of those special, special Anfield nights can you possibly have? I mean, it's not like we haven't had our fill of them, James.
I know. I think it does just sit above all the rest, doesn't it? I think because of all the circumstances that we've talked about. I mean, there has been some incredible ones just during Klopp's reign, when you know, you think about Dortmund in that first season. You know, Liverpool looked absolutely dead and buried that night, didn't they? I think they needed to score three in the last half an hour to go through. And of course, you had, you know, Dejan Lovren was the unlikely hero on that occasion. You know, you think about those nights against Man City and against Roma. You know, there has been some really, really special ones. And then, of course, you know, from the Benitez era, the semi-finals against Chelsea really stand out. But yeah, I think the Barcelona one does belong in a class of its own, just because of the caliber of the opposition, you know, and then all the circumstances and the issues that Liverpool had around it. And I think Klopp has to take, you know, a huge amount of credit for that. You know, you speak to, you know, a lot of the players that were involved that night, and they all talk about how they came away from that team meeting on the day of the game believing that it was possible. You know, Klopp saying to them, you know, this should be impossible, but because it's you lot, you know, we actually have a chance. And again, you know, the perfect example of Klopp being able to pick exactly the right words at exactly the right time and triggering the perfect reaction.
Yeah, a wonderful night. That game actually cost me an iPhone, so I've never discussed this before, but for some reason in the stand, I was next to Lee Westwood, and he was in the seat next to me. He's obviously a professional golfer, and he's relatively muscly. He's a Nottingham Forest fan. And when the Gini Wijnaldum header went in, he got involved in a collective hug with myself and my pal Liam, and sent my iPhone tumbling onto the floor, screen smashed. And I had that moment where I looked at it and thought, I can't possibly tell Lee Westwood. He's just smashed my iPhone. So from that moment on, all I think about with Genie Wijnaldum's header is Lee Westwood and a damaged iPhone. So, yeah, a sad point in it. Is there one moment in the night for you, Simon? Is there one particular standout bit?
I mean, there's so many. I mean, yeah. I actually missed Origi's winner because it was obviously not far before the end. And when... the independent being the way it was, you know, filing on the final whistle and trying to formulate thoughts when the game's going to extra time, you're trying to sort of cobble some rubbish together, basically. And obviously, just before the court, because he took the corner so quickly, I was looking down at my computer and then the ball just hit the back of the net as I looked up. And I remember there was lots of other journalists the same. I think probably missed it. I remember one of our colleagues, David Lynch, was on the row just in front of me and turned round as if to say, what's just happened sort of thing. And then suddenly everyone was up on their feet. I know you like name dropping there, Steve, so I'm going to throw in
go on.
Jason McAteer was standing next, sitting next to me and jumping over the seats in front of me. It was just absolute bedlam. Even, I mean, I won't name the journalist, but there was an Everton supporting journalist of great repute who actually had a smile on his face just by how dramatic it all transpired. You know, I think you couldn't help but get carried away by the whole emotion and drama of the night. It was just absolutely insane. I mean, I get goose pimples just talking about it now, and it simultaneously makes me happy thinking about it, knowing that we've sort of had that experience, but yes, also knowing obviously that we're sort of quite far away at this moment from being able to enjoy it. I mean, I just think that ultimately, you know, you've those memories are going to be there with you forever, you know, no matter what. Nobody can take that away from you. And that's what I'm sort of thinking about at the moment. That, you know, it's quite sad that obviously the year has passed and look where we are now, but at least we've had those experiences. Just absolutely incredible.
Memory when we were all together and obviously sharing that collective joy. No name dropping, James. You can't throw a name in to match Jason McAteer.
No. I can't live with that. No.
Do you have a bigger one? Can I tell you the best name drop that I can throw in about similar experience to Steve? When Liverpool played Man City in 2014 and beat them, there was a character standing sitting in front of me in the crowd. And when Liverpool scored, I think that the winner was by Sterling, wasn't it? I remember jumping on his back, and it was only later I realised it was Tom Hardy. It was actually, I jumped on Bane's back, and he was very, very strong as well, I must say.
Tom Hardy as in Mad Max?
Yeah, Tom Hardy from
right.
Yeah, Peaky Blinders. Yeah, big, strong man.
James, you've got to up your game here. biggest celebrity Liverpool fan, James, you've met?
Himself.
Daniel Craig walked past me in Boston? Does that count?
Yeah, that tops Simon. Daniel, James Bond, that's the man, isn't it? Boys,
you've always got to go one better.
Fantastic stuff. Don't forget you can catch up with all the stuff that the lads have been writing online on The Athletic. And there's a chance for a free 90-day trial. So if you're a big Red and you want to read all the stuff that Simon Hughes and James Pearce are currently putting on, use the code LiverpoolPod and you'll get a 90-day free trial. This is the Red Agenda on The Athletic, and Harry's sponsors the Red Agenda. Harry's was founded by Jeff and Andy, two ordinary guys who were sick and tired of overpriced razors. Jeff and Andy knew there was only one way to ensure quality, so they made their own factory. And now by taking less profit, Harry's offers great quality products for a fair price. Their amazing quality blades are now almost half the price of the leading five-blade brands. Well, Harry's trial set includes everything you need for a close, comfortable shave, weighted, ergonomic handle, five precision engineered blades, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. That's got to convince you by this stage. I've used it. It's fab for a close shave. As a listener, you can start shaving with Harry's today and claim your trial set for £3.95. Support the podcast and get your set delivered to you. That includes a razor handle, five blade cartridge, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Go to harrys.com/theredagenda right now, which I'm convinced Simon Hughes will do because he's the sort of man that needs a very close shave.
Thanks, Steve.
Come on, I've seen that beard you grow.
You need shears to get through that.
Do you know what? We were going to discuss in this podcast a great piece on The Athletic about the number of players that have scored in the Liverpool team throughout the course of the season, but we'll leave that to next week, and we'll get some of your questions on the Red Agenda inbox next week when the podcast resumes then. I'm going to say thank you to James and Simon. Enjoy your week, guys.
Cheers, Steve.
And what we're going to do now is listen to a little bit of the interview that I did with Dominic Mateo, of course, former Liverpool defender and a man who served the club so well. And for a footballer who's had everything, Liverpool, the Leeds, he's had the money, the trappings, the enjoyment, the success, of course, famed at Leeds for scoring a goal in the San Siro. A man in his 40s, thought he was fit and healthy, and then all of a sudden, 6-7 months ago, diagnosed with a rare brain tumour. He had emergency surgery and things have looked incredibly bleak. Well, they had for several months until he got to the point where, out of the blue, he was given a scan and given the all clear. He's been given a second chance at life. It's a remarkable story. Well, I caught up with Dominic Mateo to talk through the fight for his life and the bit of good news that he's had recently.
Yeah, basically, obviously, I've seen my oncologist. Everyone, I think, you know, no one really likes them calls that you have. They're very edgy and they're very tense. Luckily, my consultant rung me a few days earlier than I expected. I wasn't expecting the call, but it was so nice of Professor Short in Leeds to call me and just basically tell me that, yeah, there was some good news. And she just said she just couldn't resist in telling me, which was an amazing thing to hear. And obviously, I'm still quite emotional when I think about, you know, her saying them words to me and what she's helped me with and stuff. So yeah, it was an emotional phone call and one that I'll certainly never forget.
It's been half a year, you could probably barely believe. I mean, this doesn't happen to footballers, does it? Just describe how this all started for you.
Well, basically, I was doing my work as usual, Steve. As you know, I do a little bit of work, whether it's you know, for Liverpool TV or for Sky Sports or you know, local radio like yourselves, and you know, and I always try and make myself available for anything, any kind of work that's going, because I like to keep myself busy. And then, literally, I started getting a little bit of, I suppose, eyesight problem was the first sign, and never really thought much of it. Went and did what everyone else would do, get their eyes tested. They told me my eyes were actually really good, but they still felt a little bit blurred to me. So I kept that in the back of my head. Spoke to the doctor in Halifax, near where I live in Yorkshire, and she said, "This is a bit unusual for you to be feeling this way. So, because we never see you, I want to just do a quick test." So she just asked me to go and have a little test on my head. Because obviously when you have a problem with your eyes and stuff, sometimes they like to rule everything out. So basically said to me, go for that, which I did. And then it was very apparent when I got to the hospital, there was obviously a bit of a problem when they did the scan, because they kind of ushered me through very quickly. They put me into a private room onto my own pretty quick. Obviously, I didn't really still know what was going on too much. And just as that day progressed and that morning kind of evening progressed, I just got worse as the day went on, and then obviously it just led to a massive seizure, which obviously then put me in hospital and got me fighting for my life, where, you know, my wife and the team at Leeds, you know, basically saved my life that night and kept me going and kept me mentally going as well, because it was a tough few days that for me, and especially for the family. You know, Jess, my wife's been incredible through all the way out, all the way through that, and you know, everyone else, you know, everyone who's helped out on the way, because anyone who knows, when you've got cancer, you need somebody, you need people around you, and that's luckily what I had, and I've had plenty of people around me, ex-footballers, people I don't know too well, people just met, you know, at treatments and stuff. And it's a real mixed bag of people that I've met and I've really, you know, grown close to. And I think that's the one thing that it does in a strange way. It drags you together. And that's what I'm taking out of this now. Trying to take some strength out of it and try and move forward positively after, once you get such then bad news. It's about then, how do you react? How did I react as a footballer? I always go back to that. How did I react what would they have done? What was the little things they could have done? What can I change now? What can I do for the future going forward? Diet, what can help me? And that's kind of how I'm thinking now. And I think you have to get yourself into a positive set as quick as possible. That's the only thing I've gathered from this, from speaking to people who are in similar positions, and I've learned a lot from them guys. Even though I've only spoke to them on numerous occasions, you do learn so much from people who've experienced the same things as yourself, and learning from that, so we can all go forward, hopefully at some point, and get something to get a cure for this eventually, because that's obviously what everyone wants. And it's a difficult disease that we have, like you said before. It's quite rare what I have, and you know, brain tumour is not really a thing that's talked about too much. And I think probably there's like everything, there's more we need to go out and discuss and try and find out about it to try and help more people. And at the moment, it's just about day by day, really, to be honest, Steve.
How much have you sat and maybe reflected on that initial diagnosis, and as you called it, the fight for your life? How did that evening go?
To be honest, I literally, the only thing I remember in the hospital after that initial chat that I had is I must have been sweating, because I took my top off, which, you know, you don't really do that in hospital, do you? So I just took it off. I was obviously too hot. And then my wife's sister turned up, and she was there just to give a little bit of help, because obviously I was really in a bad way at that point. The headaches were through the roof, and I was struggling a little bit. And then obviously when I had the massive seizure, that was really the turning point for us, that we had to make the decision. My mum and dad were called. Obviously they live in in Southport, so they were called. They had to get themselves over. So Jess got them over very quickly. And it was just basically they made the decision, this is the way we're going to go, and we're not sure how it's going to go. We'll do what we can. And that's the words. When you hear them words afterwards, it's always a tough one. You know, we'll do what we can. And they certainly did what they could for me, because they, like I said, I've said it again, they saved my life. And incredible team over in Leeds that saved me, led by Professor Short, like I mentioned earlier, and the team throughout the Leeds area.
Is there an initial denial? I mentioned it before, as a footballer, as a fit guy who's never had a problem in his life. Is it quite hard to digest this news?
I think I probably still am a little bit, if I'm being brutally honest. I think it takes a lot longer. It hasn't sunk in for me. I still don't think that the news I've had is, you know, I can't really get my head round sometimes. I find it hard to take good news quite well. It's a strange thing that I've always kind of suffered a little bit of that. Maybe it's a confidence thing, I don't know. But yeah, it's just, I think the initial period when obviously you find out, and then it's the battle, and then it's the radiotherapy for me. The radiotherapy probably didn't really kick in for about 2 months, I would say. And then, not 2 months, sorry, 2 weeks. And after the 2 weeks, it got a bit tougher. So I'd say maybe the last week of my radiotherapy was probably the toughest. For fatigue and stuff, and you know, speaking with people around the hospital, which you do all the time, and that helped as well. We kind of dragged each other through a few times as well, because we're all in the same boat, whichever way we look at it, no matter who we are, what we've got in life, we're all in that same position, and we all just kind of get together. And like you say, the treatments are so much better nowadays. They try and make things so easy for you, and I found that all the way through my radiotherapy, that everyone was so helpful. You know, quite a new setup at Leeds, at Jimmy's and stuff where I've been going to. So I was lucky to have good doctors and nurses around me constantly. And they like you say, you know, we all know what the job they're doing in general at the moment. So, you know, even alongside what they're treating around the world, also, you know, they do treat everyone else who's got cancer and other diagnosis as well. You've got to keep treating people so people can get better.
This came completely out of the blue. I'd seen you a fair bit. I'd seen how much you were exercising and how full of life you'd been. You'd really taken it back to a new level, hadn't you? You were decided to get yourself into shape once again, and you'd been going hell for leather with that.
Yeah, I think it gets to the point. I don't know, you know, it's like anything in life, you know. Well, just turned 46, I was 45 recently, and I think when I got to around probably 40, I thought that was probably the right time to maybe ease down a little bit on certain habits, and you know, not ridiculous, but you know, we all, it's like anything in my era or where I grew up, it was, you know, it's part of my day-to-day. Would, you know, you go to work, you sometimes go for a beer with your mates and stuff. So all I've done is I've just, you know, really stopped all that stuff, not completely, because you can't live your life like that, but you know, I've just, I had to ease back on a few things. I've changed my diet completely, kind of plant-based diet now, which takes some getting used to, for someone who used to like everything, you know, but it's something you just got to adapt. I've got to adapt certain things, and every day it gets a little bit easier. The food, the drinks, everything we're doing, the more you do it, the more effective you can feel it can be for you. And I think diet for me now is going to be such a huge point of my of my recovery, and I think for a lot of people as well. I think it's give everyone a little bit of a wake up call with diet and stuff. If you look around the world at the moment, there's, you know, problems with obesity and a lot of other stuff around the world. So, you know, while you're in lockdown, you've got a chance to exercise. I think at the moment, you know, I can't do too much at the minute, but I'll be desperate to get back to do some running and some training and to get some normality back in my life. And I'm sure everyone else, that's what they need, because, you know, you got to think about the mental health issues around things. I see somebody once a week, Steve, you know, which helps me out with mine. Certain anxieties, or you know, I'm lucky I've got someone I can speak to, who I see every week over in Leeds, and Leeds United have facilitated me using that when it was available for me to do so. Obviously that was good of them, and it just gave me a little person to bounce off. And you know, there's been some, obviously been in a nice week for me in a way where I've been able to give people decent news. But before that, you know, the months leading up to that, they were tough weeks and tough conversations that I had to have with myself. And I think sometimes you have to have them conversations with yourself, because there's only you who knows where you're at and where you need to get to. And that's something, through Jess, my wife's help, you know, we've come to terms with, you know, what I can and can't do at the moment. I mean, at the moment, the only thing I really can't do too much more, I've lost a little bit of my eyesight on my right hand side, so I've lost a little bit of peripheral vision, and which that won't come back. So it's just, again, you know, when I can get that sorted and adjust to life with that as well, because at times you don't realize how much a little bit of your eyesight can hamper you, or you know, just sometimes for me, my vision not seeing, or bumping into stuff, I'm quite clumsy at times, and you know, when you fall over, you can end up hurting yourself, because I'm, you know, when you're a big lad like me and you fall over, it hurts a bit more. So it's just, yeah, it's like relearning, I suppose. It's like being back at school for a lot of stuff, and even educating myself, like I mentioned, on other things to eat and everything else. And I think, you know, in a way, the whole family have bought into this now, because, you know, they've realised themselves it might be good for them, and well, it is good for them to live a better, healthier life. And I think it's the way forward for not everyone, but for a lot of people. I think it's give everyone an opportunity now to maybe have a little look at like what they're doing and how they can help each other. And you know, it's nothing better than, for me, physical exercise training with somebody or having a training partner. I think going forward, that's something that I'm going to latch on to. Is find people who are similar to myself who want to get working and doing some sport as well.
You've had very extensive brain surgery,
yeah,
and by no means, obviously, it affects your abilities, as you say. There's certain, yeah, things I've seen. For example, you posted on social media, your wife Jess is teaching, yeah, you how to read again.
Yeah,
and these are fundamentals that you're sort of going back to. I mean, you know, emotionally, I suppose you're full of gratitude for the support and, yeah, having someone like Jess there. But even, yeah, even the chance to be able to learn to read again.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, it's one of those things. I was never very good at it anyway. You know, I was chatting to Robbie. It's funny, I was chatting to Robbie Fowler about it, and Jason McAteer and Mark Lawrence the other day. doing something. And that's exactly what I said to him. I wasn't very good at it anyway, so I've not got too much to learn going forward. But yeah, it is. You do take things for granted, like, you know, reading, writing for me. You know, when you're playing football, you're not really bothered. But when I came out of the game and started getting into, you know, football, you know, life after football sort of thing, and you're doing your TV or your radio or whatever you're doing, it's like I have to do all that again. I'm quite enjoying the challenge. The wife at times, we patience is obviously a massive thing in our house at the moment, with obviously all the homeschooling as well that's going on around. So I think that's one thing I've had to get better at. I think we're all impatient in life. I've been impatient as a footballer, as a player. You know, it's just sometimes, you know, just slow down. Everyone just slow down and relax and start looking out for each other. And I think that's what we do as a family now. I think we were pretty good at it anyway, but I think it's something we can all get better at. And I think that's what we're trying to buy into. And as a family, you know, that's the best thing for us going forward is sticking together. You know, it's the old cliches in life, but that's what'll make us stronger.
I'm talking with Dominic Matteo, of course, who's had the greatest gift recently, and that's a scan giving him the all clear after brain surgery on a tumour. The football world came together for you. I mean, I think it's fair enough to say immediately when you'd had your surgery and that was made public, the amount of I don't want to say tributes, because that almost comes across in the wrong way, but the amount of love that was sent your way was astonishing, Dom. When did you become aware of that?
Not that long ago, really, because like you say, my memory hasn't been brilliant, so bits of information were coming in and out. Now hopefully it'll stay there a bit longer because of some amazing memories. And like you say, some of the people that got in contact with me, you know, and it was just really emotional. And to hear from people like, you know, King Kenny, you know, who's been, you know, sending me a message, sent me a couple of messages, and Stevie Gerrard, all these inspirational people, Robbie Fowler, Steve McManaman, you know, Macca came to see me when I was struggling. Robbie's been on the phone so many times, all those people that you just become united again so quickly. And I've had, you know, conversations with Robbie. Me and Robbie were like best mates, you know, from 10-year-old right the way through. And you kind of forget about little things like that. And then something sometimes just pulls you all back together. And it's been an amazing feeling, you know, all the people who've been in contact with me, you know, even from the latest people like Trent Alexander-Arnold, you know, who I'm a big, you know, big fan of, and James Milner, who, you know, I was with at Leeds when he made his, you know, his debut, and a guy that I really admire and what he does and what he brings in life and the way he plays and all that. So I've had so many influential people and people who have really helped in what they've said, because when the people who've spoke to me and when they've said something to me, everything's meant something. You know, even from the little jokes from like Stevie Nicol, we couldn't understand half of it. But you know, just them little bits like that. You know, people like Stevie Nicol, Bumper, as I used to call him, when I played for Liverpool. These are all lads I grew up with who looked after me, and they're still looking out for me today. You know, and that's the amazing thing about Liverpool and about you know, where you're from. It doesn't matter that when you paid about 150, 160, whatever it was. That's not important. You know, you're part of a bigger journey than that when you're involved with a club like Liverpool. You know, I've talked about Leeds as well. Leeds and Liverpool, very similar, big home clubs. You know, they love the hometown teams, and you know, it's no different anywhere, I think, at the moment. And the most important thing that I can take out of all this it is getting together. You know, getting people together again and becoming more of a unit as a team, as everyone. You know, trying to unite everyone rather than just segments of certain areas.
There's a lovely message from Stephen Gerrard there, isn't there?
Yeah.
What's he referring to when he's talking about some cash and yourself?
Stevie was, when I was obviously at Liverpool, Stevie was my, we used to call it boot man or boot boy back then. And Stevie did my boots when I played for Liverpool. So I think he was just referring to a little bit of I think it was £250 I gave him as a little tip at Christmas, which
for cleaning your boots.
I didn't think that was too bad, but some people say it was a bit, maybe a little bit tight is the word. Or
I think he's implying you owe him some money there.
Yeah, probably. But you know, like I mean, to be fair, even with Stephen, you know, he's got the water and stuff. The you know the water brand over in Liverpool, Angel. Revive is it, and you know, he's been sending me waters and stuff, which is important for me to get kind of that kind of water into me, and just little things that have, you know, when you think about the Dalglishes, the Gerrard, the real legends of the game, to get them kind of messages, and to be honest, the same from any person who sent me a message, doesn't matter whether it's Gerrard, you know, the big hitters as I always call them. Everyone's played the part in making me, you know, in helping me, and I must admit as well, the people at Liverpool TV have been massive in putting a lot of these pictures and stuff together for me and helping me out, because I only actually seen the Kenny one back again properly, because obviously I wasn't in quite the right state to watch it, and it was really emotional but amazing to get that kind of messages from that, them people and from everybody.
Tell us what he said, Kenny, and why it meant so much to you.
I think with Kenny, because obviously when I've come through the ranks at Liverpool, and Kenny's always been my hero, to be honest. Even all the teams I grew up in Birkdale, where I lived in Southport, everyone was a Kenny fan, and we all, if any team, a local team got to a final, Kenny was usually the one giving the medals out, and many a time over the years, Kenny, you know. Yeah, gave me the medals when I won the medals when I was a young kid locally. So it's always been Kenny's. I've always had an affection for Kenny anyway, because you know, not just my dad being a huge Celtic fan and Kenny coming through Celtic and stuff. There's always been that affection, and obviously me knowing it. I know Paul is some quite well. So Paul sent some nice messages when he heard what had happened with Kenny. And yeah, it's just, I think I kind of understand how Liverpool works. I think you're in a privileged position when you've been through the ranks of such a great club. You get to feel that emotion. And I've certainly felt that in a good way, in a positive way, since them conversations, likes of with Kenny and Stevie and Robbie and Steve McManaman and all them players. They've all had a huge impact in me trying to get myself into the right place.
In one way, you've been lucky because you've been through the worst of things, but you've received this news at quite an early stage that you've had a clear scan. You know, many people might wait a much longer period of time to actually get that news. And of course, a high percentage don't get it at all. Yeah. So tell us how that came about, just listening to that news being delivered to you, and how it's perhaps, you know, changed your mindset and the way going forward.
My mindset's changed massively. I've got a mindset coach now, and we work on a lot of things. The brain's a very, very clever thing, a lot cleverer than what any of us think we are. The brain can do everything. So I believe a lot into that now. I'm working a lot with people around my mind and my mindset going forward, because I think it'll be amazing for me to have that going forward. But just in general, I think I'm just going to sharpen up on a little bit of everything, and I need to going forward. Steve, it's about mindset, so big for anybody who's trying to recover, and people who don't think it is. It's not true. It's a huge, huge thing, and it's a lot bigger than what we think. And there's lots more to be talked about day in, day out, you know, around a lot of subjects that can be a bit taboo at times. We don't really avoid some of them really. Hard conversations, you know, having a conversation about cancer is a difficult conversation anyway, any part of anyone's time. And when I talk about it to certain people who are in that same position, who are still in that same position, and at the end of the day, I know it's all about recovery for me, Steve, going forward. Unfortunately, we you know, you don't know if it's going to come back. That's always the nagging thing for everyone's in everyone's mind. And this is why it's so important that your mindset is strong and is right, that you keep these thoughts away from you. It's difficult at times because obviously I've got three kids, I've got a wife, you've got your lives going on, but you can't let that control everything. You have to have a little bit of you in your mind, always, you know, in control of you. At times, you know, you're going to have good and bad days like everyone else. But in the main, I just work on my mindset. And if my mindset's right, everything else will be, should be okay going forward, because I'm in a positive place. And like you say, with all the people and the doctors and the treatments and the people around me, and the still, and the thing is, the great thing about modern technology and stuff, and there's so much going on now around the world. I know things have slowed down a lot at the moment because of what's been happening, but people will get back to work soon, and you know, there'll be other things. They'll be able to, you know, there's a lot of cancers and stuff they're still exploring and looking into. And you know, I'm a big believer in this country and what we're doing. And I think further down the line there'll be more cures for different things. It's just getting time and giving people the chance to get these cures, and so we can all move forward together and all live a little bit longer, because that's all we want to do. And yeah, it's just my mindset, Steve, is massive for me now, and I think it's something that we can all do a little bit on going forward.
You've got a very rare type of cancer. That's what is the differential with you. In fact, there's only a few types of it around the world. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, Steve, there's not many of this type of cancer found around the world, and I have actually been very fortunate to get in front of somebody who deals with it day to day, because there's not many people in the world that do that. But that was through a bit of luck in a way. I don't always call things to luck sometimes, but it was the old physio at Leeds United, who was working out in America, was doing some work with some people in America, and they just got talking, and he happened to know one of the surgeons, which is, you know, you talk about a small world, America is certainly not a small place. But I got like 10 minutes to have a chat with the surgeon who's a specialist in my field, which before that I've not been able to find anybody who specializes in what's been wrong with me, with my cancer. So that was incredible, just to get in front of him, because even the surgeons, you know, sometimes in England, the Americans are that far ahead of them. They don't know sometimes what we're talking about. So there's still a lot of work to be done around the world, and people getting together and discussing all different types of stuff. And I'm sure that goes on day in, day out to try and, like you say, get some cures.
You sound so strong, but what are the moments where emotionally it's just overwhelming?
Yeah. I think for me, the first month is a complete blur, and that's the truth. I don't really remember too much. You know, when I look back at that, you see the scarring on your head, and you know, sometimes I have to look at that to see where I've been. And then I look at myself now and see where I've got to. And I have to gauge myself sometimes. With that's the way I work. I always work with my sport, football, you know, and different things. So I always have to have a gauge of where I'm at. And I think that's what I've done. But even throughout my illness, like the first month, I was like struggling in hospital, was in hospital for a month. And then after that, it felt like it was like a little bit of improvement. So it was like slowly every single week there was a little bit of improvement. And that's what I still do to every day. I just try and get a little bit of improvement in me every day. I don't push too hard, because that's what I've always done. At the moment, it's just, you know, go for my little walk, do my little bit of exercise. I'll work on my reading and writing. Luckily, Jess has been helping me out with that, which is obviously difficult at times. At the moment, we've got three kids at the moment, so it's going to be a bit livelier for a few days. But I'm really looking forward to having the kids as well, because I've not seen them for quite a while now. So that's going to be quite emotional today, actually, when I see the kids. So
Did you talk them through it?
Yeah, I talked them. Well, me eldest, obviously, and my ex-wife, I had a conversation about it, because obviously she's nearly 15. She's 15 this month, so it was right that she knew what was going on, man. And because it was so serious, David, we were talking about, you know, the decision. It was like it was life or death at that point. You know, we weren't sure whether it was going to make it through. So I just thought it was right that, you know, my eldest should probably know. They didn't have to know how scary it might have been, but you know, I thought it was important to know a little bit. And I think my ex-wife has guided her through that really, really well, which, you know, again, has been, I'm thankful of. And, you know, through the ex-wife and the husband, they've been helping out with just little things like driving and just helping me out with stuff that I couldn't do, that's been a real team effort with certain things. And sometimes you take for granted just a little bit of driving, you know, somebody helps you out doing that, and little jobs around the house or doing some shopping or that. I've just things you've just taken for granted and you've always been able to do at the moment. I'm just getting help off people, and obviously still I've got to wait and maybe another 6 months before they'll assess me whether I can even get back driving again, because sometimes they say two years or a year depending on how you're feeling. So it's just a few things I've got to look at going forward.
Is there something, a particular goal for yourself, or is it a day-by-day exercise?
I'm day-by-day at the minute. I'm feeling stronger each day, I think. I hope. But yeah, no, I think I've just learned I've got things happen. When you have something quite serious like I've had, and going forward, you've just got to be really, really careful and take things slowly. I think at times I did jump in too quick again. And then maybe it costs you a few more weeks by just your impatience from, you know, wanting to get back doing some exercise or training. So I've realised now from speaking to people is just to slow down. Eventually you'll be able to get back to doing your mad training sessions that you used to do and used to love. That's because that's what I miss. You know, a training session for me, if you've not got a sweat on and you're not tired afterwards, it's nothing for me. That's what it's all about. That's why I did a training session, as much for my mental health as well as anything else. It's just great to be out, isn't it? You know, and that's the one thing. If you look around, I don't think I've seen as many people exercise or walking ever in my life.
Yeah.
So that's the one good thing that's going to come out of all this, that people are thinking about little things like that.
Look, Tom, people will say you led a charmed life. You have. You're lucky in so many ways, but perhaps this puts the entirety of that into perspective.
Yeah, 1,000,000%, Steve. I'm a lucky boy. I've had an amazing life, and thankfully, I've got another go at this. And thankful that they managed to keep me alive for me and my family, and for my mum and dad as well, who are in their 80s, Steve. You know, so it's been difficult as well for them to, you know. They're absolutely legends. I mean, my mum the other day wasn't feeling that great, and then I told her, you know, the news. Literally, it was like, is it right to say Lazarus? She was literally became, she got cured overnight, as they say. My mum was like you say, it was brilliant. It was just like, as soon as I told her the news, it literally lifted her so much. And it's probably the best thing I've ever seen in my life is my mum feeling that happy because I'd got some good news. You know, it's amazing how selfish we've probably been in our own lives, you know, and, you know, my mum to still be thinking and treating me like that at 81 years old. It's an incredible thing. And we don't talk enough about our families and what they've done for us going forward. But my mum and dad, 81 years old, absolute legends, and I wouldn't change them for anything in the world. They're the best.
Just the most remarkable story. Dominic Matteo there talking to me about his fight for his life, diagnosed with a rare brain tumour, and thankfully getting the all clear. We wish him all the very best. Thank you for listening to The Red Agenda. That's it for another week. We will return next week with James Pearce, Simon Hughes. Of course, we'll be covering off any developments in the Premier League situation. And we'll touch on that story I mentioned before. It's well worth a read on the site. And that is about the number of Liverpool players that have scored this season in the Premier League. Very much the collective effort. That'll be just one of the stories that we'll be talking about on next week's pod. Thanks for listening to The Red Agenda. Tell your mates about it.